Hello and welcome to this week's Black Hole Cinema, which I believe is episode 25. So congratulations if you've listened to all those episodes. If you haven't, then you can actually go and find us on iTunes and listen to our whole back catalogue if you're interested in hearing several hours of us mulling over every film that's been released in the last few months. Last week, I was joined by two Chrises, and we reviewed a number of last week's films. The only one we didn't get around to doing was Woman in Gold, which will be coming up later in the show. We've also got reviews of Daniel Espinosa's thriller Child 44 and the musical adaptation The Last 5 Years. This week, I'm joined by Leslie Byron Pitt.
How you doing? You right?
Well, I'm not too bad, not too bad. How have you been?
Yeah, not too bad, not too bad. I'm in a state of transition at the moment, so next couple of weeks before I start a new role and a new job, I'll probably try to be watching as many films as possible. Great. I've got a couple of silent movies that I've picked up and purchased that I need to watch. And the last thing that dropped into my letterbox, thank you Amazon, is John Huston's Wise Blood.
Right.
So, you know, Brad Dourif for the win. It's going to be all quite interesting, all very good stuff. But apart from that, I'm good. What about yourself?
I'm not too bad, thanks. We were talking about it a bit before we started recording, but we actually kind of said that there is a lot out this week, but a lot of it is almost not worth watching. Notably, the unnecessarily comedy sequel Kevin James's Paul Bartmore Got Two, which we've both managed to avoid.
I've not seen the first. There's no point in me going to watch. Oh, what?
I know. Like usually we'd have Tony here to watch all that kind of crap for us, so we don't have to. But he's not here again this week. He will be back for our big Marvel special. It does all kick off, really, doesn't it, from this Thursday onwards. You know, a number of titles coming up over the summer. And obviously two trailers that broke this week, specifically the Star Wars trailer, Star Wars 7. We'll talk about that one and the other major trailer release later on in the show. But why not, let's get kicked off with the reviews, I think. First up is last week's major release, Helen Mirren and Ryan Reynolds' turn in Woman in Gold.
Your son the lawyer, how is he? Some letters I found in my sister's belongings. I need advice from someone I can trust. Can't you just help me on the side?
There is no on the side. This is a full-time job.
Oh, how can you see out of those glasses? Filthy. Here she is. My aunt, Adela. Painted by Gustav Klimt.
That's quite a painting.
She was taken off the walls of our home by the Nazis. And since then, she's been hanging in the Belvedere Gallery in Vienna.
And now you'd like to be reunited.
Wouldn't that be lovely? And then there's justice.
Woman in Gold stars Helen Mirren as Maria Altman, a Jewish refugee who takes on the Austrian government alongside Ryan Reynolds' young lawyer, Randall Schoenberg, to recover artwork she believes rightfully belongs to her family that was stolen by the Nazis during World War II. Directed by Simon Curtis and was written by Alexa K. Campbell. Also starred Daniel Buhl, Max Irons, Katie Holmes, who I haven't seen in anything in ages, and Daniel Buhl, who basically plays Maria and Randall's only Austrian ally when they're over in Europe. And he basically helps and assists them trying to win their case. What am I going to say about this film?
Philomena 2.
It very much is Philomena 2. It's funny you mentioned that. It's been compared actually a lot by a lot of people have kind of said that they've tried to emulate what they did with that one. And I kind of think that worryingly now any film with Helen Mirren or Judi Dench is kind of going to be compared to anything kind of lighthearted, which this does have its dark tones in it, but anything that's kind of reasonably lighthearted is just going to be compared to Philomena. It last week at the box office it was one of the stronger new releases from last week, so you know they definitely take money. I went to see a performance in the Picture House this week, just gone, so into its second week, and it was still reasonably busy, so it's certainly films that they're going to continue to make. Obviously you mentioned that, you know, the performances generally are very good, and that's definitely its strength. I think Ryan Reynolds is proving kind of this year that he's actually a very capable actor. He's kind of putting right his mistakes from a few years ago when he was in horrendous stuff like Green Lantern, which, to be fair, is not just it's not solely down to him. It was an awful film, but you know, I feel that with this and earlier on in the only a few weeks ago, even The Voices, which he was brilliant in, and again here, you know, he gives a very sturdy performance. Helen Mirren, you can't go wrong with Helen Mirren. She's brilliant. Daniel Buell, who I only really discovered, was it last year or the year before, where he starred alongside Chris Hemsworth in the film. The title's just gone out of my head, but the one about the
Rush.
Yeah, yes. Which, you know, blew me away. I thought he was amazing in that film, and I almost didn't recognise him in this. And it's I've not seen him in too much since seeing Rush. Maybe I've just not come across a lot of what he's done recently, but again, as I said, you know, he's, you know, very good in this, and it's always brilliant to see Charles Dance. He pops up, you know, in it as well, and so you've definitely got, you know, a very, very strong cast. The biggest stumbling block, oddly, is that it's just a bit too dull and slow and repetitive, and you kind of feel like you've been there and done that twice already in the film. You know, you feel like you've got countless scenes of Ryan Reynolds tearing his hair out and looking extremely frustrated, either at work or at home or on an aeroplane or in a hotel room, and just like, yeah, or I could get the picture. He's a frustrated man. And then you've got Helen Mirren's character Maria, who seems to suffer from this chronic indecisiveness where she flips back and forth, which I guess is supposed to fill time in the film, and I'm sure in reality, obviously, she probably did have her reservations at times, but in terms of your actual kind of enjoyment, it's a bit frustrating and tiresome to see her go, oh yeah, we're gonna do this, and then 2 seconds later go, oh, I'm not sure, my heart's not quite in it now, and then 2 seconds later again to be back going, oh yeah, let's do it. And that kind of flip-flopping is, for me, really frustrating to watch. And arguably, they could have cut 20 to 30 minutes off the film. It ran about 110 minutes, but probably could have done it all in about 90. I feel like films nowadays, they have to be 2 hours. It's as if they make films, they go, right, we've got to at least fill 2 hours. If you're not done 2 hours, it's not worth it. You know, films these days, they rarely are 89, kind of 90 minutes, whereas, you know, is it a recent thing, do you think, where films are overly long?
Well, no, I mean, the interesting thing for me, when you say if films are long, I think people start, kind of landed on something at a certain point, and films that we kind of remember and know are usually about 90 to 100 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
Or, you know, possibly 110. But, you know, looking back, as I was saying, I mean, we were talking before recording, and I think actually during recording, I've got some silent movies to watch. And one of them is obviously, you know, the very controversial Birth of a Nation. And that's 194 minutes, and it's silent. And, you know, so they did have these lengths going on all the time. Mm. I think the problem I think we have is, I don't think a lot of time that narratives are strong enough to fulfill the time taken.
Yeah. And with this, they've got a really great story at the heart of it, and it is really interesting. It's not something that I personally knew about, so I kind of went in not knowing anything about the story. But it is a really interesting story. I just think they could have done it a little bit better. The historical scenes, so the flashbacks were very well done. You know, they didn't shy away from, obviously, the truth of what happened back then. And it, you know, it was quite interesting to see actually how it affected all manner of people, from the poor to the shop owners to, you know, the dignitaries, which, you know, her family, you know, Maria's family were, you know, they were very, very rich. You know, the fact that they had this wonderful painting that ended up getting put in the, you know, the Australian National Gallery, you know, is kind of proof of their wealth. But they went from having all this wealth to having nothing, obviously, when, you know, the Nazis invaded. And so it's kind of interesting from that level to see how it didn't matter, you know, whether you were rich or poor. As far as they were concerned, you were Jewish and you were all the same.
Yes.
Yeah. And again, as I said, this film didn't shy away from showing that. You know, you did have them, you know, scrubbing the streets and having to write, you know, Jew on their door and stuff like that, which I feel we've become a bit desensitized to a little because we've seen it so much. But it's important, I think, not to forget that part of our history, why it's important that films like this are telling those stories and keeping that memory alive, I guess. Obviously, I mentioned the cast. You had also Max Irons, who's Jeremy's son. And he, I don't know whether he actually is his voice or not, but his character, Fritz, who's Maria's husband, is an opera singer. And his opening scene, he's performing at his wedding. He's singing to his new wife. And it's really interesting. I want to know whether it's actually his voice, because he's actually very, very good. And if not, he's very good at dubbing. but you know, he's very good in it. I mentioned Charles Dance, and the other person is, I'm going to pronounce her name incorrectly, I know I am, Tatiana Maslany, I think. And again, she's very good, and she does a brilliant job of kind of, obviously she's playing a younger version of Helen Mirren, effectively. And she does do, you know, a very good job trying to mimic, you know, Mirren's expressions and kind of, her body language and the way she holds herself. She does a very good job in those scenes. And I think that's what the strength of the flashbacks are. Not only are the most kind of interesting scenes in it, her and that supporting cast that are around her in those scenes, are all very good, and they do a very good job, of portraying the kind of things that, these people had to go through. But ultimately, it could have been better. It's not something that I necessarily think I would have gone and watched anyway. You kind of mentioned it's not really aimed at us. Our audience is aimed at that, kind of 50 plus audience. But I think for them, they probably sat there and loved it and thought it was brilliant and wonderful. But I think the source material was so rich and they could have done so much more with it that I just think it just let me down a little bit. But it's probably worth catching. It will be in cinemas certainly for the next couple of weeks. So if you fancy giving that one a go, then do.
People see a masterpiece by one of Austria's finest artists. But I see a picture of my aunt, a woman who used to talk to me about life. We should be reunited with what is rightfully ours.
Before we move on to our next review, we'll have a quick rundown of last weekend's box office here in the UK. Straight in at number 10, in its fourth week now, the Divergent series Insurgent. It's taken just over £7.5 million gross to date in the UK. It's fared a little bit better over in the States, but probably hasn't taken quite the money the distributor probably would have hoped it would. At number 9, surprisingly, still hanging around, is Get Hard, which we briefly talked about last week when we reviewed Hot Tub Time Machine 2. Fun enough, Chris Byrne, who was on last week with us, actually watched it, I think yesterday or the day before, and actually said he quite enjoyed it. So, different things for different people, At number 8, I mentioned it earlier, unfortunately, Paul Bart Mall Cop 2 is in at number 8, new this week, taken just under £500,000. Just above it is the just reviewed number 7, Woman in Gold. That one's also taken just under £500,000. Number 6 was our film of the week last week, John Wick, which I've got to say, I've actually watched it again. I really enjoyed it that much. Do go and see that one if you can. I'm sure that will be still around in cinemas. Number 5 is the SpongeBob movie, Sponge Out of Water. Now we're kind of back into term time now. Those films that were kind of released around the Easter holidays, I'm sure will quite quickly drop out of the top 10. Number 4 is our highest new release. Quite surprised me, actually, is The Duff. That's taken just under £1 million in its first week. And I'm quite surprised that was actually the one out of the films that released last week to be the highest. But you never know. I am surprised. At number 3, we have Home. That one's taken £18 million in 4 weeks in the UK. At number 2 is Kenneth Branagh's Cinderella. That one's taken just under £2 million last weekend. And still at number one is Fast and Furious 7. Did you see that one when it was released, Les?
Yes, I did see Fast and Furious 7. It's a little bit ridiculous. Well, I say a little bit, it's very ridiculous.
But it knows it is, doesn't it? It knows it's ridiculous.
Well, yeah, I mean, the one thing I kind of liked is these films have evolved from Point Break rip-offs to basically be parodies of themselves in their own little way. You know, there's a moment where Kurt Russell just looks at the camera and winks, and it's not so much at Vin Diesel. He's clearly winking at all of us. He knows what film he's in. And I generally had a good time of it. I'm astonished by how much money it's made. I do not think it is just because of Paul Walker. No. I do think there's something about those films that people are very interested in.
Well, as of today, it's taken $1 billion worldwide, so that's, you know, an astonishing amount of money. And I'm sure when they take this weekend into account as well, I'm sure that will be bumped up even more, and it might even take a little bit as we run up into the second Avengers film, which obviously will probably explode this weekend. But that concludes our box office top 10. Next up, we have Daniel Espinosa's thriller, Child 44.
Remember when we first met? You thought that I was rude.
He was staring at me.
I was mesmerized by your beauty. They will always only be you.
They came as fast as they could.
There has been a terrible accident.
Alexei's son has been hit by a train.
A train?
He's claiming his son was murdered. I am sure you realize murder is strictly a capitalist disease.
You have to be quiet. There is no murder in this country. There is no murder. Do you understand?
Based on the first of a trilogy by Tom Rob Smith and set in the Stalin era of the Soviet Union, the plot is about an idealist, pro-Stalin security officer who decides to investigate a series of child murders in a country where supposedly this sort of crime doesn't exist. The state would not hear of the existence of a child murderer, let alone a serial killer. He gets demoted and exiled, but decides, with just the help of his wife, to continue pursuing the case.
Yeah. So that's the synopsis. I don't know what to say. This film is kind of all over the place. One of the things that I find myself talking about with friends is the idea and the idea of adaptation. And one of the things that always upsets me about films is when someone turns around and goes, the book's better because of this, that, and the other, and everything else like that. And automatically, when we talk about these, you know, these contrasts of book and film, we completely forget that the word is adaptation. It's being adapted for screen. It will not be the book. It will not. It may not have the richness. It may, you know, there may not, you know, there may not be something there that it does. It's not necessarily better or worse. It's just, you know, you might favour the story being told in one medium over the other. You know, there is no better.
No.
But here. Seems to be the exception that proves the rule. And I think one of the reasons why is in terms of it, as this as an adaptation of a book, it's quite clear that they couldn't get all, they didn't know what aspects of all 400 pages that they really wanted in there. It is overstuffed. This is an overstuffed, dull film, full of frustrating Russian accents and characters disappearing and subplots that seem to go nowhere and unsatisfying resolutions. I mean, the thing that really annoys me so much is a character will appear and it tries to start as quickly as possible with, you know, this character that we first see, obviously that becomes Tom Hardy's character, an orphan child who runs away, and, you know, he basically finds a new father in the Russian army. And then becomes part of Stalin's secret police. So they're rushing through this in order to try and gain this sort of momentum. But the film is just, it's not strong enough. None of the dramatic aspects carry any weight at all. And it's really, frustrating knowing how well the cast is. Yes. At one point, Charles Dance appears out of nowhere, and right at the end, and you kind of get the feeling that certain characters were in here and they've had bits of their character just left on the cutting room floor. Yeah. Then Gary Oldman is part of the selling point here. He's getting really, he's supposed to be there as one of the main characters. He doesn't turn up until like halfway through the film, and even when he does turn up, he's not there for that long. It doesn't seem to know how to build and conclude scenes, let alone the whole narrative as a whole. I don't think it's a very particularly interestingly shot film either. Visually it's not very good at telling the story. It's action sequences or fight sequences are muddled, and I'm guessing, if I was to say badly choreographed, the person who choreographed the fight would be very angry at me, but I don't think they are badly choreographed. I think they're very clumsily put together in terms of the editing. Mm. So fast, and you don't seem to have any sort of geography there. The film as a whole has a really interesting aspect to it. The idea that this man that is part of the secret police and is is in a world where they say there is no crime, there is no murder in paradise, is this running through line all the way through. So there's no murder in paradise, even though there is clearly someone killing children. Mm. That's something really interesting, and to see how someone changes and someone gets molded by that. But the film doesn't do well enough with Tom Hardy's character, mm-hmm. in terms of building up his issues and his problems and his internal conflict. So, by one point in the film where you're having this character question his morals and what he's done in his life and any aspect of that, and really on the nose stuff by the end of the film, it's not particularly rewarding. You don't feel satisfied with the outcome of this. Mm-hmm. And it takes so long to get there. Mm. It's just so long. It's not even that long a film, but it just feels long. It seems overstretched. It seems overstuffed. It seems like there's characters in there should have a lot more to say. It's generally a disappointment. I don't want to attack it as much as I've seen some of the other reviews floating about the internet, but it's generally not a great film.
As I said, it's supposed to be part of a trilogy. The film itself doesn't seem to me like the type of thing that I'm going to see, two films out of. It does seem more of a self-contained film. Is that perhaps where, you said about plot points going nowhere, is that perhaps the reason for that? Is that, they potentially have another two films, or at least there were another two books where a lot of these, plot lines would have gone and we would have explored Tom Hardy's character further, do you think?
Well, no, I just think it just doesn't know what it wants to do, because the main story as a whole, the actual narrative as a whole, is not rewarding enough, mm-hmm. as opposed to Hardy's character. You just get the feeling that they're trying to do so much. I mean, I was having a few reviews of the actual book, mm-hmm. of Child 44, and one of the things that they're saying about the book is it tries to encompass and taking all these other aspects of Russian history as well, mm-hmm. and whether or not that works, that's tough. And I just don't think it has the constraints. I really don't. I don't think it's so much plotting for a sequel, although near the end you can see what they're aiming for. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's looking at that. I just think it's overstuffed with things it has to say, and it doesn't rise and build properly. No. I found myself looking at thinking of two films while watching this, and one of them was Fritz Lang's 1931 film M, mm-hmm. which in the 100, you know, it's about 100 minutes long, but it manages to encapsulate all the hysteria and worry and social issues of the time and still manage to be ambiguous and powerful and hard-hitting. Mm-hmm. And it deals with a similar aspect of the idea of a child killer, not only a child killer who may or may not be plagued with what he does, and a sympathetic child killer. That's a tough thing to do. And poor Paddy Considine, who's an actor who I really love in films, once again has very little to do, and it's just a bit of a it's just a little bit frustrating there. And then the other film I was thinking of was Inglourious Basterds by Quentin Tarantino.
One of the
things that I love about Tarantino's film, and you know, what anyone says about the film, whether good or bad, they do usually point out one of the highlights being the opening sequence. Mm-hmm. when you first meet, you know, we first meet Mr. Lander, and that sequence with the farmhand and the farmhands on there, and the family, and whether or not there is people hiding. Mm-hmm. And just the amount of tension that is drawn up, that is an unbelievable scene in terms of how it is made and concocted, and choice of shots. I think this is the thing that annoys me so much, is choice of shots. I don't want to say something bad, because obviously the crew are doing their best, but I'm looking at the shot choices and what they do in order to gain tension, and it's just not there.
No.
You need, you know, I do get frustrated, and every so often in certain films I do count the seconds between when they cut shots and everything, just in case. And this one is so haphazard in its shooting and how it puts certain things together, and it's just a little bit frustrating more than anything else. You see other films about war, or even something like and I know this is West Germany as opposed to Russia, but the one that got nominated for the Oscars, and I love that film, I really do like it, and I can't remember for the life of me what it's called, but you look at other films and the way they're put together and how they shoot things, and I look at this and you just get the feeling that there was more tension on set than there was in the film.
That's never good.
That's, you know, I find that to be a massive issue. I do get the feeling that when you have so many great actors like Noonie Rapace is on there, mm-hmm. Paddy Considine, as I said, Vincent Cassell, this is an all-star cast, mm-hmm. but it's a very drab, dull way of putting these people together, and it's just a bit of a shame, to be fair.
They very much sold the film on the fact that it was produced by Ridley Scott. Did it kind of have any Ridley Scottness about it, or?
Well, no. I mean, the thing is about a lot of the Scott-free films is they're usually quite well, with him as a producer, they're really usually quite well put together, no matter what. They're, you know, they're slick productions. This doesn't. It's got the right location, and every so often there's some really lovely photography, and then every so often you've just got a handheld camera for no reason, or lots of, not quick cutting, not like quick cutting in that sort of way, not like a Russian montage, but more in the sense of just, it doesn't allow scenes to breathe, just moments just seem to just go and pass, and you know, you get the feeling when you watch certain films that was an important moment, we need to remember this is why it was building up to, this is an important piece of information for later on in the film, whereas this one it doesn't have that, it feels very televisual,
mm-hmm.
and very sort of, you can just dip in and out of it when you wish to, and it's just a bit of a shame considering.
Child 44 was probably the major release of this week, so we'll be in all the good cinemas around the country probably for the next few weeks yet, so if you wanted to catch that one, then you can do.
All children, ages 9 to 14, 43 in all. 44. My friend's son was murdered too.
Before we move on to our final review of the podcast, we're going to briefly talk about the two big trailers that were released this week. They've both created a lot of buzz on Twitter and social media platforms. The first one we'll talk about is the Batman versus Superman trailer.
Is it really surprising that the most powerful man in the world should be a figure of controversy?
We, as a population on this planet, have been looking for a savior.
We're talking about a being alien whose very existence
they are not telling us the truth.
Challenges our own sense of priority in the universe.
Human beings have a horrible track record of tragedy. Following people with great power.
Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Chaos.
Maybe he's just a guy trying to do the right thing.
We know better now, don't we? Devils don't come from hell beneath us.
They brought their war here.
No, they come from the sky.
The world has been so caught up with what he can do that no one has asked what he should do.
Tell me, do you bleed? You will.
What did you think?
I'm not sure about this whole Batman in Superman films anyway. I know, obviously, if you've ever read the comic book Hush, you know, Superman makes, you know, makes an appearance in there, and they do cross over often in their big histories. But I'm looking at this, and it looks like they are really trying to do a very dark project.
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily think that might be the way to go with someone like Superman. I don't know. I mean, there's some really lovely little moments in there. And unfortunately, unlike unlike Man of Steel, it doesn't have that really... I think the Man of Steel trailer, whatever you think about the movie, I think that trailer is very good. And I don't think this has the same sort of grab you and just, you know, take hold of you in that way. But it's, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, it's out now, so we'll see it, and hopefully we'll do what it needs to be completely honest. I hate coming onto this podcast and just being the big misery cast. it's just one of those things where I think we need a little bit more. I'm kind of a little bit frustrated with how the marketing's gone, how they've leaked it, and then now they've just released it, because obviously it's been leaked. I don't like the fact that all these blockbusters are jostling for position in a way that they don't necessarily need to.
Yeah.
Scott Mandelson, who writes for Forbes, came up with a really it was a really good tweet where a couple of tweets where he just stated, and I do agree, where it's just like, well, if they had just waited for Star Wars to finish its news circle, which does happen in these days, where this is the greatest trailer of all time, then we stop.
Yeah.
You know, that's not until Christmas, so people will forget about it until they need to see it again. And they just released it at the time when they were going to release it.
Mm.
Then they would have had a lot more, you know, a lot more buzz about it, and people would be a lot more aware and everything else like that. This, now that it's been leaked and it's come out and it's kind of just falling out and whatnot, I just don't think it's not generating the same sort of buzz. And I also feel that these things kind of play better when you actually watch them on the big screen.
Yes, definitely.
I wasn't the biggest fan of the Age of Ultron trailer, but I feel it plays so much better when you watch it on a big screen with the right tool, so to speak, to view it.
I think possibly, I don't know whether it's maybe because I've got more of a Marvel bias, perhaps, but it didn't grab me quite as much, I don't think, as the Age of Ultron trailers, particularly the first, and I think it might be the third one, Avengers trailers, that they really caught me. And something Tony actually mentioned is that all of the trailers actually that have been released this year so far, you know, not all of them, but on the whole, they've not spoiled too much. They've teased enough, Spectre, obviously, which was released a few weeks ago, the Star Wars one, which we'll talk about briefly in a moment, and the Avengers, all three of the Avengers ones, and I believe there was a fourth one released a couple of weeks ago as well, but all of them haven't really gone out and spoiled the story. Arguably, you know, you've got stuff like, whereas Jurassic World, which is coming out, and basically there's no point watching the film because you've seen it all in the trailer. But I think it is something that this does do well. As I said, maybe it doesn't quite grab me as much, and maybe I did want it a little bit more, but it doesn't overly spoil anything. I still don't really know the circumstances between, you know, these two characters coming together, having, you know, not being a big comic book reader, but, you know, certainly not DC, so I don't know the history of why these two characters would perhaps come together in each other's worlds. So I'm kind of, when I go in and see this, I will have no kind of expectations of what to expect. So it is interesting that it doesn't spoil anything. But as you kind of mentioned, I think it doesn't quite whet the appetite enough. And maybe that's because, as you said, it was leaked and perhaps should have waited waited for its moment in the sun. But, you know, I thought it looked cool. I'm going to watch it regardless of what the trailers show me anyway.
No, I mean, yeah, that's kind of a given. I think my issue with this is not so much that it's a necessarily bad trailer, it's just that the work is just pretty much already done. All you need to do is just show those guys getting ready to get together. That's it. Yeah. That's all they need to do. I mean, the line exchange that they do have is nice and it is good, and I'm not entirely sure about Affleck's gravelly voice.
Yeah, that's very much our first look at him as Batman.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I'm still not quite convinced, but we'll see. I think he's got big shoes to fill, though, hasn't he? So
yeah, indeed.
It's going to be difficult. And I don't know about the eyes either, the glowy eyes and the kind of metallic look to the suit. I don't know if that's, a kind of... something that's been used kind of before, a kind of style that's been used before, or whether it's just specifically for this film. I suspect it is, because as you kind of mentioned, the way they've kind of gone down a very dark route with this. Do you think that's because of the success of the original, of the most recent Batman trilogy, that the kind of style of that is, do you think that's what kind of DC have kind of gone, right, that's our identity now, that's what we're going to put on everything?
A little bit. I do think that. I think with the DC stuff, and I apologise to any comic book fans out there, but I do think they're kind of scrambling about a bit, looking to try and find out what sticks well.
Yeah.
Looking at how Marvel has, you know, what's happened with Marvel. The dark approach, I mean, the glowing eyes and everything else like that, I think has got more to do with the fact that we've got an older Batman now. So... I'm guessing he will be using a lot of, instead of being so great and on the peak of his powers and whatnot, there'll be a lot of him, you know, with all these machinery and gadgets, because he's an older dude.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, we'll have to have a look. I mean, I was always a little bit worried about Man of Steel when I watched it, because from what we know of Superman and the nature of Superman from the movies. Mm-hmm. They've always been so colourful and bright and optimistic.
Yeah.
And that kind of takes a lot, you know, Man of Steel takes a lot of that out of there.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of tough. I think that's a difficult thing. I mean, even Marvel, in their darkest hours at this moment in time, the cinematic universe still seems to be very bright, colourful, very human, you know, humanist films. And I'm not entirely sure if DC have got the same thing. I mean, it's very hard to turn around with, you know, remembering what happened with Superman Returns, which did make a lot of money, but just didn't make as much money as they thought it would, or they wished it would. And looking at how Superman Returns came out and the way people were interacted with that, so now they kind of went on the other spectrum, and now we've got this kind of dark, slightly morbid Superman who, you know, doesn't mind killing people.
With this one, obviously, it's the big opportunity for them to kind of test the water for an Avengers style, you know, Justice League film, which they've been teasing for years, and I'm still convinced will never happen. But this is their opportunity to get it right.
I try not to speculate too much. I'm someone who hates when a trailer comes out and straight after you get this is a trailer, it's amazing, and all, and then after that is here's a shot by shot breakdown of what's going on.
It's like, well,
what? No, that's not what you use your film studies degree for, is it, really? You know, so you kind of have to be on tenderhooks every so often with stuff like this. So, you know.
Yeah, but arguably for me, the two DC films that are out next year, the one I'm more interested in seeing is Suicide Squad, because I think for me, the strength of DC is its villains. So I'm a lot more interested actually to see that than I am really to see Batman vs. Superman. Batman vs. Superman, Dawn of Justice, will be out next year, the 25th of March. So this is the first of many trailers, I'm sure, that will be coming out over the course of the next year. The other big one, obviously, was Star Wars Episode 7, The Force Awakens. We had a teaser earlier on in the year, but this is the first kind of major trailer.
The Force is strong in my family. My father has it. I have it. My sister has it. You have that power too.
Are you a big Star Wars fan?
No.
No, me neither.
No.
I was like, yes, I love Star Wars. I'm so excited to see it. I can't be honest, I'm not interested in the slightest. And I said that.
No.
I'm probably the only film person in the world that is not remotely interested in this film.
No, I think there's a few of us, we just don't say
it. No, don't say it. Edit this bit out if you feel free, so we don't get unsubscribed to. By the droves of people that listen to us, hopefully.
Yeah, I think it's all fine. It's great that, you know, that these trailers are paying lots of lip service. Yeah. I'm now getting, you know, but the thing is, for me, I'm not a fan of Star Wars, so watching this stuff makes me just turn around and go, okay, well, yeah, you're getting everything there for people that love this stuff anyway. Yeah. You know, that's fine. Once again, it's a little bit like Batman and Superman. These trailers are almost predetermined for the people that have already made up their mind of what's going on.
Yeah.
And it's just a chance for them to see stuff moving.
Yeah.
For me, there needs to be something in there for me. I will say that in both trailers, John Boyega, whatever his role may be, and I know he was mentioning something during Comic-Con, but I kind of ignored it. But whatever his role may be, that is what I'm interested in. I am interested in what he is going to do. Everyone else, I really don't care. I mean, that last shot.
Harrison Ford.
It
just reminds me of everything I don't like about Star Wars, which is just the ridiculous characters like Chewie and... like, what was the Jar Jar Binks? I'm sure I'm hoping to God he doesn't turn up, but those kind of characters remind me for every reason why I don't like watching them. And you know, I will admit I've not even seen all of them. So you know, maybe I can't judge outright. But for me, I just was just face palmed my hand when he said that line. I'm just like, that's just terribly cheesy, and I'm sure the people that love this stuff loved that, but for me, I'm just like, I now want to see this film less. But as you said, I'm sure it works for the people it works for. They will have known, but when they were making that trailer, that Harrison Ford had to be in it. I'm not too familiar with Mark Hamill a bit more familiar with Carrie Fisher, but I don't believe either of them popped up, did they?
No, Hamill is obviously doing the voiceover.
Yeah.
And once again, it's just massive fan service, yeah. Isn't it? It's just, this is going on. I think ultimately, what kind of frustrates me is the, like, Lucas is correct in saying that these films were made for kids and these, yes, and everything else like that. And I think there is a consensus out there of people who kind of realized that one of the reasons why they didn't really get on with whatever the last trilogy was for them, it's because they've grown up and it's for another batch of kids. And I think it's the same for this now. Yeah. So when I see all this lip service, I'm not particularly interested, because I just don't see why we keep playing and playing and playing to people who, yeah, they've grown up with it. It's now, 1977. And do we have to see, like, Harrison Ford in a Star Wars movie? Do we have to, come on.
Yeah, it's like, I just don't know if it's going to work with Mark Hamill and Carrie Fisher. They look so different. Carrie Fisher's had so much Botox, her face doesn't move anymore. And, Mark Hamill's put on a few pounds since, he originally played Luke Skywalker. So I just don't know if it's going to work. And obviously you mentioned it is predominantly a kids movie. But the strength of kids movies these days, not just live action, but the strength of animation and how well they do at the box office is actually this going to succeed where the previous films, particularly the most recent trilogy, even though, as you said, the older fans didn't quite enjoy it as much as they did because they've grown up, but whereas obviously the youngsters lapped it up, but because of the strength of kids films, I bloody love animated films, but the strength of your Disney's and your Pixar's and your DreamWorks, the stuff that those guys are putting out, is this actually just going to kind of get lost in the crowd, and is it going to pick up enough of an audience this time round?
Well, I think it will. I mean, we mentioned in the box office, Fast and the Furious 7, a billion worldwide.
Yep.
And I think it will be the same here. Yeah. I think with one thing about Abrahams, and I'm a bit of a Star Trek fan, the original, the first film that he created.
Yes,
I think one of the things, he's a very canny operator at slick, well-produced films, whether or not you like them or not. And if you do like them, for me, it's, if I like them, they're kind of like Star Trek, and they can bring in a new crowd. Yeah. And putting in sabotage is, for me, is a nice touch, and having that sort of aspect, and knowing enough about Star Trek, but having enough to try and do certain things to change and alter that. And that's one of the reasons why I don't think I like Into Darkness as much, because they utilize too much of the old guard stuff.
Yeah.
But
Abrams knows as well, what is going to make the fans excited, because I think more importantly, he's a fan himself of these series that he's now picking up. Obviously, back in the day, he was worked a lot in TV, obviously, Lost and Alias and various other shows, but now he's in this film world. A lot of what he's doing, or practically everything he's doing, is picking up existing franchises that he obviously loves. And so he can sit there as a fan and go, I want to see this, this, and this, and I'm going to make it happen. And that's what he did with Star Trek. Leonard Nimoy was there in that film, not because, he needed to be there, but because he knows the fans wanted him to be there. And, it's exactly why, as you said, why is Harrison Ford back? Well, he's back for this very reason, because people will get excited about him being in it. They'll be excited about Mark Hamill being in it, and Carrie Fisher and all the old guys that are coming back for it. They might not need to be in it, but they need to be in it because the fans want them to be.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things that I think one of the problems is I never felt any need for these films to continue on. Obviously other people do, because they've got money to make and mouths to feed, and if there is an audience out there for more of this, for more stuff, then obviously it should, people will go and make it for them. I don't, I'm not one to turn around and take that away from people. I'll try to anyway. Yeah, but one of the things I do have an issue, I do find issue with, is when you are someone who isn't that interested in it. It's like, for me, when I listen to a lot of people, they go, oh, when I was a kid, my first thing I saw was Star Wars and everything else like that. I didn't have that. Mm. The first film I saw was Masters of the Universe. And yeah, so therefore, you know, I don't have that thing. I watched them quite later on. It wasn't that they were silly. I thought they were entertaining for a lot. But I do find issues with them.
Yeah.
I do find them dragging and, bit draggy and dull in certain places. And, you know, when I went to the cinema to watch Phantom Menace, oh, my goodness me, that Trade Federation nonsense. Really? And now we're getting lots of people turning around and actually being very revisionist about it. And being very sort of like, it wasn't, you know, that other trilogy wasn't that bad. No. And I'm just like, I don't know, I just think it, I don't know, I think it passed me by in the first round, so I find it very difficult to try and get in with it and get in touch.
I think you have to have been bought into it early to appreciate this. And it kind of is the same with Star Wars. You know, I came to it, again, a lot later. And that was down to the J.J. Abrams revival. It doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to go back and watch it again, and watch the old stuff, shall I say, because I can't look at it with the same kind of appreciation that someone who watched it originally, 20-odd years ago, did, so that they appreciate it and love it in a different way. And that doesn't... It's not to say they can't look at it objectively, but so often they can't.
worst thing about the bigger fans is how dare we have anything other to say than it's the greatest thing in the world.
Yeah. So if anybody's actually still listening now, after we've just flagged off one of the biggest franchises in the world.
Hey, I'm sure they don't like my favourite film either. House Party's got a 5.5 on the Internet Movie Database. So,
up next, our final review: The Last 5 Years.
Jamie is over and Jamie is gone. Jamie's decided it's time to move on. Jamie has new dreams he's building upon, and I'm still hurting.
The Last 5 Years by Tony Award-winning composer and lyricist Jason Robert Brown is a musical deconstruction of a love affair and a marriage taking place over a 5-year period. Jamie is a young, talented, up-and-coming Jewish novelist who falls in love with Kathy, a struggling actress. Their story is told almost entirely through songs using intercutting timeline device. All of Kathy's songs begin at the end of their marriage and move backwards in time to the beginning of their love affair, while Jamie's songs start at the beginning of their affair and move forward to the end of their marriage. They meet in the centre when Jamie proposes. It stars the delightful Anna Kendrick as Kathy, and Jeremy Jordan, who I assume is a big Broadway star, as Jamie. And basically, it's just the kind of the two of them through the whole film. You get some brief, cameos, none famous as it were, but you get some, other people popping up now and then, but none of them really saying or doing all that much. Just very intimately concentrates itself on these two characters and their relationship. The issue is, you just don't believe it. they're both lovely and attractive young people, but they just got very little chemistry on screen. And the idea behind the structure of the film, the fact that you've got these two contrasting, the fact that the timelines move in opposite directions is interesting. And I'm sure it works very well on stage. It's an adaptation of a big Broadway show. I'm sure it works on stage, but in the film, just get a little bit lost. And at first I thought, am I just stupid, is it just me not paying attention? Because I've got to be honest, I lost interest about 30 minutes in, and I'm a big musical person. I love musicals. I regularly go to the theatre So it's not that I'm just one of these people who hate singing through the films. You know, we've talked about it. I remember when I was back on the first wave of Black Hole Cinema, where I talked about Les Miserables, and Tony obviously said about the fact that, oh, he's not really keen on films where they sing all the way through. It's fine if you've got something like, you know, a bit more fluffy and light, Mamma Mia or something like that, where obviously they've got it interspersed with lots of dialogue.
He needs to watch On the Town and realise what he's missing.
Yeah, and that's the thing. But, you know, Les Miserables is my favourite musical of all time. Even though the film has its pitfalls, you know, it doesn't matter. And, you know, for me, certainly the fact that they sing all the way through doesn't put me off. And that's not what's putting me off here either. It's just dull. It's dull, and I don't know if the music's all that good. You know, it's kind of... I guess it's obviously got a realism to it. It's telling a very ordinary story of these two people and kind of the beginnings of their relationship and ultimately the end of their relationship. And Anna Kendrick is wonderful, but I think she's one of the hottest stars at the moment, you know, alongside, you know, Jennifer Lawrence, etc. She's really hot property at the moment, and she's delightful, but I just don't really believe her and this chap who is an arsehole. He's not pretty... You know, the first thing you want if you're going to tell a story about a relationship is that you've got to be able to believe in the relationship. And he's just such a tosser that you're just like, why the fuck are you with her, love? Or why are you with him, rather? It just doesn't... He's just not very likable. Basically, you know, he's very highly strung and, you know, he's very ambitious and it's very selfish. And... For God's sake, he cheats on the poor woman. You know, who could cheat on Anna Kendrick? You know, come on. And it just doesn't ring true. And for me, I don't want to say he's the main issue, but he's so unlikable from the beginning that you're just not interested. And as I said, I did really struggle to get through it. I did stop it, I think. Once or twice, I think I had to. I took a break, went to the loo, which I wouldn't dare do. If I'm totally immersed in something, but I just did lose interest. I remember looking at my watch, and I'd only watched half an hour, and it felt like I'd been watching it for 3 hours. and as I said, it's an interesting concept. The fact that you've got her moving backwards and him moving forwards. And I got to the middle part, not too badly, but after that I started to lose where they were in the timeline. And it was only the fact that I knew that she was moving backwards that it was that I knew kind of where I was. It wasn't particularly clear in the story because their relationship is so turbulent almost throughout it, that it seems like they have a pretty naff relationship for 4 out of the 5 years that they're seemingly together for. And as I said, the songs themselves, you know, they aren't that great. They're certainly not ones that I would, you know, sit and put on my, my Spotify and listen to again. Whereas completely different to, I watched Begin Again with Keira Knightley and Mark Ruffalo a couple of weeks ago, and that soundtrack I've had practically on repeat since I saw the film. This one I couldn't even there's not even a song out of it that I go, oh yeah, that was good, that was memorable. Just wasn't immersing, just wasn't immersive at all. And it just is a bit dull as well, and that's just a shame, because on paper, as I said, it's a really interesting concept, and the way they've made it is interesting. It just didn't hold my attention, and it should have done. I think Jeremy Jordan was miscast. You know, he didn't bring any kind of likability to the role at all. There's one brief moment when you're like, oh, he's kind of sweet, but otherwise he's a dickhead throughout the rest of the film, and it just didn't hold my attention. So
see, that's always a problem. I mean, I don't have an issue with unlikable characters. Yeah. I think you kind of, I think often they, you know, they do make, you know, they are quite interesting. But I do find that while they, you know, if they may not be likable, but they've got to be engaging.
Yes. Yeah.
and they you have to engage them in a certain way, and you have to, you know, be a part. You may not sympathize with them, but you may have to sort of empathy there, or some sort of relatability. Mm. Not saying that you will, you know, you will like them or anything, but I think case in point there, I watched recently 3 Days of the Condor, which is an amazing film, really good, really, really good film. And then at the end, you get to a point where a character is saying stuff that is quite despicable, really against what many would think of as human nature. But you understand why he's saying, and you're when I say you're with him, you're not with him, but you are comprehending and seeing why he would look at the world that way. Yeah. And that's the engaging thing. I find it really difficult, but if it's like you're saying, you're with, you get a character who's completely unlikable. If he's not engaging as well, then I don't think it, you know, it's doing the right thing. And I think it's really important with something like this, where you have a couple. It's one of the reasons why I'll never watch Paranormal Activity again.
Next week, we'll be back with the big Marvel special, where we review the whole lineup, of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and then obviously finishing off with a big review of The Avengers Age of Ultron. It'll actually be the biggest show we've done to date. We'll have 7 people on the panel together, so there is the saying, too many cooks in a kitchen spoils a broth, but we'll find out. So come in and join in the fun for that one. You can find us on Twitter at Black Hole Cinema. You can find myself on Twitter at Dan Thomas Taylor, and your Twitter handle?
It's Afrofilm Viewer, so just Afrofilm Viewer, and then you'll be able to find me.
Lovely, and I'm sure you'll be back on again soon. So thanks for
joining. No problem.
And that's it. We'll see you next week.